Beautiful.
All right.
Omar?
Yes?
You good?
I'm gravy.
All right.
3, 2, 1.
You're listening to the Phase Gray Network.
We invite people
of all backgrounds
to share their stories.
Through nuanced conversations
and forward thinking
and not taking ourselves too seriously.
Everyone's story matters.
Every voice is important.
Life is polarizing.
But not everything is black and white.
Come join us
as we fade to gray.
Hey, everybody. We're coming in with an episode. Omar, Chris, and I. Yeah, I know. I always do it. Omar, Chris, and I are here today with noted author, activist, theologian, and pastor Brandon Robertson. And I just want to note this because this guy has been making the news, okay? He's had articles in the New York Times. He's been in the Huffington Post.
Oh, he spoke fake on NPR. News. Oh, okay.
He's written 12, he's like written and contributed to like 12 books, and he's gay. So I'm like super stoked to have this conversation today. So to kick things off, Brandon, how are you doing?
I'm doing so well. It's good to be here. Thank you.
We are so excited to have you.
Oh.
Part of like what we like to do at Fade to Gray is really hear people's story and kind of allow people's story to paint the picture at being able to ask questions and kind of look at things from multiple angles. So tell us a little bit about yourself, especially now that you're a pastor. Did you grow up Christian? What's your story like?
Yeah, so the long short story is I grew up in a non-religious home in Maryland. And when I was 12, I ended up going to church with my neighbors. My dad was an abusive alcoholic, so really I was just trying to find a way to get out of the house on the weekends and started going to church. And in that church, I heard for the first time this message of hope, this message that there was a God who loved me more than my earthly father loved me. And for my young 12-year-old soul, that was the message I needed to hear. And so I had kind of a typical conversion experience, went down the aisle while they were singing hymns and gave my life to Jesus. And then really from that point onward, I also had a sense of calling. I felt like I wanted to give my life to preach this message to other people, to help other people come to know that they were loved, that their life had purpose and meaning. And really, I continued to follow that path all the way up through college when I went off to Moody Bible Institute in Chicago, which is a conservative evangelical school. And during my 4 years there, everything changed for me because I always say Moody has one of the worst models for the type of school that it wants to be because it's this fundamentalist Bible college, but it's in the heart of downtown Chicago. And so I would learn this conservative theology in the walls of the school. And then when I'd walk outside, I'd be confronted with reality and cultures and experiences that I hadn't had before. And it would often contradict my theology. And so I began having to wrestle with, well, either my theology is right or reality is right. And I knew the answer. I had to go with reality. And so I started rethinking what I believed. And during that same time, I started wrestling with my sexuality as well. And really, over those 4 years, I had my own radio show on our campus radio network and started blogging and really started interviewing people that were more liberal Christians, but were way more loving than the evangelicals I was around. And in Bible college, over the course of my 4 years, they tried to kick me out 6 times, but not for anything fun. It wasn't because I was smoking weed behind the dumpster. It was because I was talking to people they thought were heretics. And
you shouldn't smoke again, weed you find behind the dumpster, man. I'm just telling you. There's better options out there, especially in San Diego.
Is it? Well, in California, we've got good dispensaries too. So, So I essentially my faith started shifting primarily based on experience, right? Like these more progressive people were more like Jesus, and my college was consistently rejecting me. A professor found out that I was struggling with my sexuality, and they outed me. Oh my gosh, you got the weed.
That's a whole nother conversation. Not on Facebook Live. You're in California, I'm not.
Yeah, I love it. Basically a professor found out that I was struggling with my sexuality and outed me to the entire faculty. And so my final year at Moody, they said, basically, if you're going to graduate, we need you to do a year of conversion therapy.
Hold up, rewind. We got to interject here. There's, you've shared so much information, and that is a pinpoint. But can I ask before I want to back up just a little bit to talk, because you went to Moody. Moody's pretty conservative. Moody's pretty out there in that regard. So can we just unpack that a little bit. What led you into seminary? And then I want to talk about what happened there, because that sounds like an interesting story.
Yeah. So for me, Moody was liberal. The church I grew up in, Fundamentalist Baptist, I was looking at schools. I don't know if y'all have heard of like Bob Jones University. I was looking at these very fundamentalist schools. And Moody, when I looked it up, I mean, you were allowed to hold hands with your girlfriend at Moody, which was something that was forbidden at Bob Jones. You had to walk on the other side of the street. And so I thought, man, this is a liberal school, and yet it still has credibility among evangelicals. And the other side of it was, at that time, I had left the fundamentalist church, and I was an intern at an evangelical megachurch, and my pastor graduated from Moody, and he told me essentially, if you go to Moody, we'll help pay for everything, because I was supposed to be the protege to come on staff after Moody at this church. So I go off to Moody thinking it's going to be this, you know, a little bit more moderate Christian school. And little did I know that my own worldview, my own politics, my own experience as a person would change so dramatically. And within my first year, I found myself like on the exact other side of Moody. I came in and I was actually more conservative than most people. And within a year, I was the biggest heretic on campus. So,
all right, let's talk about that little transition there. That's a big one, especially in a year's time. Chris, you had a question though. I felt like I cut you off. You just haven't been here for so long.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, that's very, you know, welcome back.
Who are you?
All right. I was going to say that's like a pretty quick transition, you know, 1 year to kind of go from being super ultra conservative, to, you know, being quote unquote a heretic, or at least, you know, supporting people or talking with people that would be seen as heretical. Was there like a catalyst, or was there like some sort of event that made you want to talk to these people? Like, what was it that made you start questioning things and start to change from that very conservative fundamentalist view to a more liberal, open view?
Yeah, probably the time frame was more precisely, it would have been a year and a half into my Moody experience. So probably halfway through sophomore year, freshman year, I went in, and I think what was so surprising to me was I was significantly more conservative when I went into college, but I don't know if y'all have ever met, maybe some of you went to Bible college, but Bible college dudes are some of the most arrogant prick people that you'll ever meet. And these guys were such bullies. I would come in and I was sharing like my version of theology, and what we would do for fun is sit up in the lounge late at night and just like spar with one another. And they, again, like I was looking at a mirror of my own theology in them, and I was like, is this the kind of guy I want to be? And I did my best to hold on to it. I tried, because that's what men were supposed to be like. But it really was walking, what we did for fun on the weekends. I was literally the best Bible college student there was in regards to not breaking the rules. And so me and my friends, instead of doing anything fun on the weekends, we'd go to multiple different religious services at different faith communities. And it was in that experience of going to the Roman Catholic Church down the road from Moody, which we were taught was the great whore of Babylon, the Catholic Church.
You'll go to hell if you go there, man. Catholics, I mean, it's bad. You'll get abused.
But I was sitting in mass, and I remember hearing the priest give his homily, and it was such a beautiful a homily. But it was this social justice, very beautiful articulation of the gospel. And I felt God there. And so it was really those experiences within religious context that I kept bumping into that made me at least begin exploring and asking questions. And that was the whole radio show I started. It was like, how do I get a platform so that I can access these theologians that are big or whatever and get them to talk to me? And so we did that. And surprisingly, we're super successful in like who we were able to get, which made me quite visible on campus, at least, as a heretic by association with these Rob Bells and Nadia Boltz-Webers, if you know these people. And it was really those conversations and those experiences that started the deconstruction for me.
Oh, you just said a key word.
Deconstruction. No, that's a good answer. That's a good answer. It's interesting. We've never really talked a whole lot about Bible College and kind of some of the things you brought up in your experience in your freshman year too, about like, I personally never went to a Bible college. Master's Commission, I'm not sure if you're familiar with that. It's kind of like the renegade sort of thing, but you know, it has all the same like sexual purity rules and things like that. And it's the whole idea though of like sparring, like the way you put that, you know, like mental sparring, like just like that. I'm looking back and thinking about like, is my experience in Master's, that's really what like the dude, just what all we wanted to do is just like, you know, beat each other up with our knowledge and how much we knew and what we're learning from the Bible and how we see it. And, you know, I guess it was fun. I was into it for a while. I mean, like you said, staying up to like 2-3 o'clock in the morning and doing that stuff. But it is interesting that, you've pointed that out, and I just wanted to kind of camp there for a little bit, maybe hear like other people's thoughts on that, because my one time when I realized kind of like the same thing you did, where like kind of face to face, is this really who I want to be? Because I grew up Southern Baptist and then went to Master's Commission, is Assembly of God, for people that don't know that. Anyway, I remember after leaving Master's Commission, I actually got kicked out for smoking weed and some other things. And
shocker.
my roommate I got in this little town in Kansas, I'm just trying to remember how to tell this story. I remember like, we thought we'd be perfect roommates because I just got a Master's Commission. He had just like, he wanted to go to Bible college. He was doing the Southern Baptist thing. And I remember like we got this room together. I think we both were just shocked about like who we actually were in this room. And like, cause all he wanted to do, it was argue theology with me. And at that point in my life, I was so into grace and I was just like, none of that matters, man. Like, let's just love Jesus. And you know, like, and it was this whole back and forth thing, or he tried to start a Bible, like some Bible study, but it was just a weird power dynamic. So anyway, sorry for that long ramble. I just thought that like when you brought that up, that is such an interesting power dynamic in Bible schools, and it's like almost like showing how big your dick is, how much not, like, you know, it's that whole like how big does it swing.
Well, it's our way of competing. I mean, you look at people in, okay, I hate to say the secular world, but you know, if we're talking like Bible college, it was like sports in a way. That's how you showed your superiority and your knowledge. And it's what made you look good and feel like Jesus loved you. If you could fight it out in regards to scripture and arguments, I always felt like I was closer to God. Like it's as if I won something. I don't know.
It's such a weird world because it's literally, I mean, it's, that is the entirety of what the Bible college and Christian theological college world is like. And it's even like, I'm just remembering back, there is even the standard, like women would really want a strong-minded, arrogant, somebody who could throw down Bible yeah. verses. Like that was a thing right. in the dating culture. Of the Bible.
They live with you and then they're like, what the fuck did I just marry? You know, like, what do you expect?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a weird world. And I think you said it exactly right, that it is our version of finding legitimacy. It's the only version mm-hmm. that gives us a sense of meaning in life. And that's really sad. Like that's preparing these pastors to go into a world where nobody is spending their days thinking about theology. Like who, you can't shepherd anybody like that. And it's just, anyways. I could rant on that for an hour.
No, but. It's good. I know that's probably where nobody was really going with the conversation, but it's something that like we talk about deconstruction a lot, and that's where we broke off because you brought in, you know, you're talking about your deconstruction. But I was like, man, let's unpack that for a second. Let's sit on there for a minute. So I don't know, Chris, I know you were Did you go to school for any of that?
No, I didn't go to Bible school, but there were, you know, lots of people that I was involved with at church that went, and man, they started getting into Rob Bell and all these heretics. And I just didn't have any part of it. I thought, man, these guys are going to hell. What the hell's going on here, man? These people used to love Jesus and now they're turning liberal. You know, I almost felt like Alex Jones, they were turning the frogs gay. Well, yeah, and it's just, you know, that's not what the Bible's about. The Bible, you know, says that people are going to hell. The Bible condemns homosexuals. The Bible, you know, that's not what my God does, you know. So for me at the time, of course, I'm in a completely different place now, but for me at the time, those Bible college kids, they were the ones that were heretical with all their knowledge and stuff that they were learning from authors like Rob Bell and whatnot. But I'm actually interested because for me, it wasn't necessarily the Christians that did me in. For me, it was the Bible itself. And so I'm actually extremely surprised and shocked that as a gay man, that it wasn't the Bible that did that for you, that it was actually Christians that kind of led you on the path of deconstruction or whatever you want to call it. How do you feel about the Bible? Is it something you think is inerrant? Do you think it's bullshit? What's going on with it?
It's certainly not inerrant, but I think, my view of the Bible now obviously is very different than what it was 10 years ago. I think the Bible today is a helpful book insofar as that it records humanity's journey of consciousness and kind of our spiritual evolution. And I think it's remarkable, especially the Hebrew Bible, Old Testament, how you see these kind of circumstances where humanity tries to justify their terrible behavior, their conquering behavior, their colonizing behavior by saying God told us to do this. And we continue to do that today. And I think like those parallels make the Bible profoundly important. We also can't deny that Bible is the basis of Western culture. Like the stories, the rhythm of the Bible is how we do our life, whether we like it or not. And so we have to treat the Bible with some level of respect. But we always say, I mean, I try to take the Bible as it was intended, which I mean, like Genesis is mythology and poetry. Okay, so if we understand that, then you can actually begin to get something worthwhile out of it. But like I've been spending too much time today on TikTok debating people who are angry that I said Adam and Eve weren't real. And it's like, you're asking the text to do something it's not meant to do. It was not trying to describe how humanity began. It's a story about human nature. But yeah, so.
Great answer.
It's a science book, Brandon. I was taught that we turn to the Bible for all of our answers.
All right, Ken
if
Ham.
We have any questions, the Bible will tell us.
He's got a pretty cool museum,
I
though.
I might throw up.
Yeah, have you been to the Ark yet? Has anybody here been to the Ark yet? I heard it's going out of business, but I don't know.
I hope.
So are you like writing letters back and forth with that Joshua Ferenstein guy? Are you guys pretty good friends? As Christians,
who is this Joshua Finn?
I don't know. I'm just making that one really religious dude. You know who I'm talking about now. Okay. So, all right. Back on that question of the Bible, because you
bombed.
Said a very nice, neat little thing there about how the Bible, you know, is not meant to be looked at that way. How do you know that?
Well, this is, again, another thing I've been debating on TikTok about. I think this is the thing. I think one of the worst things to happen in Christian history was the Reformation, because on one hand, it was great to liberate knowledge. On the other hand, giving an ancient book to lay people and telling them that they can understand it just by reading it is terrible. And I mean, I've done 8+ years of academic study of scripture, and I know the culture, I know the context, I know Greek, and I know Hebrew. And so I am pretty confident that I can wrestle with the text in a way that's faithful and accurate. Nice. And most people believe, however, that they can just open the Bible, take it literally, and be happy and on their way. And that is what has caused, I think, so much destruction spiritually, but also in the world today. It's why Christians support the nation of Israel in their conquest of the Palestinian people. It's like you're not understanding the culture or context of scripture, and you're taking what you want to justify your political agenda, which, of course, I do as well. But at least I do it with a knowledge of Greek and Hebrew.
Right. So your dick still swings the biggest.
Always.
I have an affinity for linguists.
You guys are referencing
so,
that
yeah,
so
awesome.
Many times.
Very cool. Very cool. I think that's a great answer. I mean, you know, as someone who can actually look at the original text and say, hey, this is what it actually is talking about, I think your dick swings bigger, you know, in that respect. So I think that's a great answer. But I will say, you know, what do you do with the scriptures that you don't like? Do you, because here's what I'm thinking. I think there's a huge movement right now, and I apologize for dominating the conversation.
No,
I'm
going to
let you all talk here in a little bit. But there's a huge movement right now of people saying, you know what, I don't really like the Bible. I don't really like the God of Jacob. I don't really like the God of Abraham. But Jesus is pretty cool. I like his message of love. I like how he rebelled against the establishment of the religious right. And so I'm just going to, you know, choose to take that. Would you say, okay, I'm very curious about this because I'm thinking that I'm starting to understand what people are trying to do here. Would you say that when Jesus came around, that he wouldn't have even claimed to have been the God of Abraham's son? He was simply just preaching love. And that was maybe something that was bestowed upon him. Like, what's going on there?
Yeah. Yeah, you might get me in trouble with this one, but I'll tell the truth. I don't think Jesus thought that he was God. I don't think Jesus was interested in starting a religion. I think Jesus and the earliest Christians, Peter and James, who grew up with Jesus for 33 years as his brother, they had an understanding of what Jesus was doing as trying to be a social revolutionary prophet within Judaism. He wanted his followers to continue being faithful Jews while also living in opposition to the Roman Empire and trying to start an insurrection literally from the ground up. And he did it through peace and justice and these very nice things that we talk about and preach about. But I think, and I would say the way you articulated how people use the Bible, that is how I use the Bible. And I make no qualms about, I think understanding the Hebrew Bible in its context is so helpful and important, but I'm more concerned about the four Gospels and particularly just the Gospel of Mark, which is a gospel that we know is historically the most reliable to get what Jesus was actually trying to teach ethically and morally and spiritually, and then try to take those lessons and apply them for my people at my church to our 21st century context. But I think we really miss the point when, and Christianity today misses the point, when it becomes about converting people to a religion that Jesus himself didn't even belong to. And I also have this theory that the Apostle Paul actually hijacked Christianity in a very unfortunate way. And there's a whole scholarly theory that's starting to emerge saying that Paul never met Jesus. Paul had no knowledge of Jesus. The early apostles said Paul wasn't an apostle. He claimed to have a vision on the road, and all of a sudden he's now an apostle. And he preaches a message that's antithetical to what Jesus was preaching. And I think there's some really interesting stuff to contemplate there. So I'll leave that.
That's great.
I want to ask a question for Seth before Seth asks it. Do you think Paul the apostle was gay?
No. I don't.
Gosh darn it. Why not, Brandon? He couldn't. Listen, it was his thorn. Listen, the man, he talked more about relationships and telling people to, you know, it's better to like jump in the ocean with a thing around your neck than to, you know, date a woman. Like he was super sexually repressed because he was struggling with his homosexual desires.
This man knows the Greek. He can tell us what it was. What was his thorn?
Nobody knows what his thorn was.
I know.
But I doubt it because I think if he...
Why?
It's going to be hard. There's no compelling argument either way. But the Apostle Paul was a high-ranking, deeply studied, elite Jewish man homosexuality in the Hebrew context wouldn't have even been a question. So he might have been oriented towards being gay, but like it wasn't an option for him to even think about or choose. But I just think there's a lot of gay theologians that try to go in that path. And I just think because it's not provable in any way that ultimately we lose conservatives when we try to say Paul was gay or even David and Jonathan were gay, because we can't actually prove that. But there are people in the New Testament who are gay, and we can prove that. The eunuch in Acts chapter 8 was gay. Jesus talked about gay people, eunuchs, who, again, were people who either were born intersex, decided not to have sex because they were gay and became celibate and served in the courts of women, or had their penis chopped off as a way to keep themselves from sexually sinning. And so I think we haven't done enough study about eunuchs, and they're the real queer people in the Bible.
Wow. That's true. Interesting.
Great answers, man. I'm so glad. Like I said, I was sick before this conversation. I'm so glad that I showed up, because brother, this is a great conversation. And Chris, you've had some great questions. I've missed you. And I want to kind of continue kind of down some of that like path of like the Bible. And I loved your answer of kind of like focusing on Mark, mainly on Jesus and like, you know, his, because there were some political ties and things like that. So is there a hell? And
no.
Okay. Well, then that answers the second question then too. Okay. You say no as in no internal conscious torment, or no as in not existing at all? Like, you know, like, because that's also like a, you know, an option too.
So. Yeah, I can't see a reason why it would exist. On questions of the afterlife, I always say I've never died, so I can't give a real answer there. But if my basic understandings and impulses about what God is are true, then there's no room for hell. And there's also not room for the conception of heaven that's often been put out there as this kind of eternal sunny place where we all go and are good forever. Like, honestly, if heaven is the way it's articulated by conservative Christians, it sounds like hell to me. If like everything's perfect, yeah, and there's no struggle and no story and nothing to do, like that doesn't sound
just to
good.
Sit there and sing songs all day to God. That sounds awful.
Yeah. Yeah.
And all your friends like here on Earth or in some other place. I'm like, oh, how does that work?
Yeah.
The Trump supporters.
Oh God. Do you think that Jesus even believed in a hell or an afterlife? Because, you know, you see whenever he's talking to the thieves on the cross, right? He's saying like, you know, today you will be with me in paradise. What is he talking about then?
Yeah, we absolutely know for a fact Jesus didn't believe in an afterlife, because Jewish people, there was no concept of an afterlife. Yes. And so what Jesus, I mean, this is the thing that people misinterpret. Jesus's word that's translated hell is Gehenna. I was in Israel last summer. It refers to the Valley of Hinnom, which is directly outside of the old city of Jerusalem. It's a lovely place. We had a picnic there. I picnicked in hell. It was fun. And it was the garbage dump. It's the image of refining. Jesus was saying, if you keep walking in these destructive, greedy, selfish ways, you're going to end up in the garbage dump, literally. And I agree with that. We are going to hell as a culture right now. We're walking towards Gehenna. And then paradise was a Jewish understanding of Sheol, which is the place that all dead people went to. And yes, this is true that in the Jewish conception of Sheol, there was a kind of good side and a bad side, but the idea was everyone's going to get resurrected in the end, and we are all going to face judgment, but there was no concept of them being thrown into hell and been taken off into heaven. Like, Jewish people didn't think that.
I think that, from what I understand, that sort of doctrine kind of bled in through actual, like, teachings out of the Middle East, what's the word?
Zoroastrianism. And
there you are, yes. That's what I was thinking of, yeah. Interesting.
So with some of your answers you've given us today, Brandon, why not just be some sort of form of Jew or Judaism? Like, that seems like that's Jesus never came to change that culture, like, necessarily. Like, and so Christianity, like, is something that, like, was people trying to figure all that out. So it's kind of like, why stay in Christianity if it kind of is like the bastard son of what Jesus was actually trying to do anyway?
Great question. I've wrestled with this a lot. I think
the paycheck.
I don't know that I'll say that. Okay. What was that?
God damn, Chris. he did spend 8 years like, you know, getting to where he is now. So
the good news is my church that I have now, like, they're so on board with all
That's
of
awesome.
This. So paycheck's not on the line, but the thing is, I think Jesus, he was teaching people how to live a certain ethical paradigm out. And that ethical paradigm translates into every culture and every religious context. And so I think it is very possible to follow Jesus and be Hindu. And I think Jesus intended it to be that way. He didn't teach really religious teachings at all. He spent a lot of time challenging the religious teachings of his own tradition. But when you get to the core, he says all of the law and the prophets are summed up in, you know, love God and love your neighbor as yourself. If that's the core of his ethical principle for how he believes God wanted the world to look like, that can be adapted into a humanistic lens, that can be adapted into an atheistic lens, that can be adapted into a Muslim lens. And so,
what about political lens?
This is where I get in trouble, but I'm a proponent. I think Christianity, according to Jesus, is inextricably linked to politics. And I think it's been done wrong, but 90% of what Jesus taught was political. And again, you'd miss that if you didn't know the culture and context, but I'm sure you all know, like, the phrase Jesus is Lord that Paul adopted was a parody of the phrase Caesar is Lord that was on every coin in every government building. Jesus was proclaiming something deeply political. And I honestly think in this moment of American political history, we have something to, like, there's some really pertinent things about Jesus's politics that would be very helpful for us.
Wasn't Caesar also said to have been born of a virgin?
Yeah. Essentially, there's a lot of evidence. First of all, I'm going to go down a very weird path, there is a lot of evidence that the gospel narratives, the four gospels, each one obviously has a different kind of narrative theme to Jesus's life, but the writers parodied, one of them parodied Homer's Odyssey, which is the Gospel of Mark. Anyways, they adopted these myths that were prominent in the pagan world and then wove truth about Jesus in there, but they wanted to make him look like the Messiah. And so they create genealogies and they create stories that fulfill prophecies. And I think that's what we have in the Gospels. I think Mark, you have a lot less of it, but there are definite parallels throughout Mark to Homer's Odyssey. And you just, that stuff you can't just chalk up to being uncanny reflections. I mean, clearly somebody knew what they were
certainly
doing.
Yeah.
And it worked.
Or even
Christianity spread throughout the Roman Empire, right?
Yeah. And, you know, with what you're saying, it almost seems like you don't think Jesus is divine.
So this is where I walk a line here. I do think Jesus is, I would say Jesus is the incarnation of God. And I would say, I don't think Jesus thought that he was God. I think both are true. When I'm talking about the historical Jesus, that is different than the Christ of faith. And I won't deny, I won't deny that I experienced when I was 12 years old, something that I understood as Jesus Christ that transformed my life. And I continue to encounter that Jesus. And I can't explain that. So I believe in that version of Jesus being God. And I think the early disciples also experienced something like that. And I think that can be true. And Jesus, the historical man, could have also been primarily a social prophet, a radical revolutionary who became God in the mind of his followers later on. Or, I mean, I'm also not opposed to supernatural belief. So Jesus did rise from the dead spiritually, and there's something more going on is what I'm saying. So.
Gotcha.
Again, I love it. And it's going to segue into another question. It may be like one of the last ones. I don't know how much time we have left, but
we haven't let Seth ask him any questions.
Well, this is something that I think
this will be one of my last questions.
How about that? This will be one of my last questions, and then you guys can take over from there. And I think it might trigger Seth anyway, because do you think that some of Jesus's teachings, or the direction he was going with his teachings of the whole, like, of being Lord and how set politically and socially, we'll just go that way. Are we gods? Can we be gods?
No, you didn't.
That is not where I thought you were going.
I know.
No, you did not bring that up. Okay. Yeah. Let him go. Brandon, have fun with this.
Yes, we are.
Thank you.
The New Testament says, Peter writes, Paul writes, Jesus was the firstborn among many brethren. The idea of Jesus being the Son of God, this is the political message that was so revolutionary. Caesar was the only Son of God. Jesus comes along and says, I am the Son of God, but also you're the children of God. We're all children of God. which was subverting the power structure of the day and saying, actually, yes, there is a bit of God in all of us.
I see it. I see it as a message for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. That's as much of a Jewish belief as there could be, being made in the Imago Dei, the image and likeness of God. We are literally, the Genesis myth says God breathed into us and that became our life. Paul quotes the pagan prophet, which is my favorite quote of his in the book of Acts, and says, in God we live and move and have our being. So yes, I think Jesus thought that we were all partakers in the divine nature, and the rest of Christianity taught that. And Eastern Orthodoxy has always taught that, even up until today.
Is that not just a metaphor for the fact that we're all made up of star stuff? I mean, it's kind of the same concept, is it not?
Yeah. I think for me, my understanding of it is that there is something eternal inside of all of us. We don't understand consciousness scientifically. We don't understand consciousness philosophically, but I think there's something in consciousness that connects all of us together and will transcend this life. And I think that's what we call God.
And whether it be some sort of Israel deity or not, there is an undeniable connection in humanity with each other, with nature, with everything that was, you know, made or created or, you know, that happened, however it did. Yeah. There's some sort of connectedness. And I think whenever you say that you had some sort of a supernatural experience when you were 12, it's very likely that that is just something that you created within yourself because you, sure, because you needed a way out.
What are you trying to like tell this guy what he experienced when he was 12? Come on.
He needed a way out of the experience he was going through with his abusive father. And I 100% identify with that. Whenever I found Jesus, I needed him. And at that time, I've said this before, I think Jesus did save me at one point. You know, he's not my savior today. I saved myself. But I think at the time I needed him, you know, so I can completely understand that. And
I think that's the utility of Christianity, even from a secular perspective. I think people have to acknowledge that, yes, religion has great evil attached to it. And it's also the very thing that literally does save people from ending it all. It's the thing that pulls you back from the ultimate existential dread. And I think that makes it worthwhile. And that is also going to keep it from ever going away.
Floor's yours, Seth.
So I've kind of been sitting back and just listening because, Brandon, you've already like crushed two of my biggest arguments that I throw around all the time. And that
we're not
is
gods
that,
and Paul wasn't gay.
You
yeah,
got it.
Yeah. And you've just destroyed both of them. And that, well done. Bravo. Bravo. But I interrupted rudely as you were sharing your story when we kind of diverted into the theology conversation because you mentioned going to Moody and then I kind of jumped in and I wanted to back up. But I want to process that a little bit because I am also gay and wanted to go into the ministry, did an entire year internship at a mega church, essentially trying to earn God's favor. It never worked. And then I went to gay straight camp for 3 months and did all of that, then became a counselor to try to help people who were struggling. But in that entire process, I never got to a point where I was really ever truly able to accept myself because of my religious upbringing. So I want to talk about your when I interrupted you, because you mentioned that you were at Moody Bible College, and then they eventually found out and they were going to make you go to conversion therapy. Like, what happened there? Like, finish that story.
Yeah, the end of that is essentially I went through conversion therapy for a year. It was a very light version, though. It's not as intense as what we've seen in the movies recently, but I did it. It didn't work. And I graduated Moody by the grace of God, literally. I just felt so disillusioned afterwards because I knew now that I was gay. I still didn't know what I believed about it. And I moved home to Washington, D.C. And really, to fast forward through that next year, I started leading a national organization called Evangelicals for Marriage Equality in D.C., was right before the marriage equality vote. And that got me a lot of criticism. We were in Time Magazine. We were in all the top publications and Southern Baptist started coming for me. And I was still identifying as straight, by the way. Wow. And I ended up losing a book deal because of my support for marriage equality. During that time, reporters started digging around in my life.
Who was the publisher?
And it was in Pennsylvania, actually, Destiny Image Publishers. They do like Bishop T.D. Jakes. All right. And
burn them
Joyce
books.
Meyer.
All right, go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah. And so when I lost the book deal, some reporters started digging around. A reporter from Time Magazine found out that I was gay, that I had like started coming out and I was still identifying as straight publicly. And I ended up getting outed in Time Magazine in 2016.
So you've never actually outed yourself?
By Time Magazine too. That's way to get outed if you can get outed, I guess.
It was, I mean, traumatic for the day or two that it happened. And then like my dating life in DC was incredible because I was out there, man.
I bet it was.
But seriously, like, I am grateful for it because like I didn't have to talk to my parents, didn't have to talk to anybody. Everybody found out and I was there. And then really, I mean, the rest is history. For the next 5 years or however long it's been, I had this platform to talk about LGBT Christian issues, and I've been doing that. And I went to seminary, did some intense study on particularly first century Greco-Roman sexuality so I could understand the biblical texts. And then was supposed to go work for the Clinton administration at the White House Office of Faith. That was the goal.
Really?
And then Trump won. So then I ended up becoming a pastor, which has ended up being really great. So.
All right. So Brandon thinks that Trump winning is very great. Very good.
You heard it here
because of Donald Trump. You heard it here.
So when did you repeal your support for the Nashville statement?
Ooh, that was like my first year here at Mission Gathering was when that came out, and I did lead. I led the not to toot my own horn here, but we got 7,000 or 8,000 people signed on to my response to it called Christians United, and kind of just gave the big middle finger to. I'm going to cuss, but I'm not going to cuss about this.
You don't care. Please do.
Yeah. For those of you who are not familiar with that, of course, that was a bunch of pastors getting together to say, now we don't validate homosexual.
Digging in deep, doubling down on it. It was dumb.
So given, I'm going to push a little bit further. So given your upbringing and then into ministry and realizing you were gay, especially at Moody Bible College, what was Grindr looking like at Moody? That's what I'd like to know. And also like how you transitioned through this emotionally to get to the other side.
I wish I knew Grindr existed at Moody. My life would have been so different.
That would have been so much fun.
Yes. But honestly, so there's a whole nother narrative here. I'm going to write a book about it someday because the first day I got to Moody as a freshman, I met the guy who lived two doors down in the dorm. We became best friends. And within like 6 months, we ended up going out for coffee and he needed to tell me something. And he told me that day we went to Starbucks and he said, "Hey, I just need you to know I struggle with same-sex attraction." And I had never, ever admitted it before. And in a moment, it just came out of me and I said, "Me too." And this guy who became my best friend, we pastored at churches, we're as youth pastors together over the next 4 years. We built this, what was akin to a dating relationship, but we couldn't call it that. There was no physical aspect to it. And
a bromance.
Yeah. But wait, I've had some of those. Than that because it was like we were dating. If it wasn't at Moody, we would have been dating. And that ended up one of the other reasons I ended up in conversion therapy was my junior year, me and him slipped up and for one time actually kissed each other, which was life-changing and amazing. And then because of our guilt, we ended up going and reporting ourselves. And then they were like, "Okay, well, clearly you're not taking this seriously. And so now you need to do conversion therapy." And we did that together. And pinnacle of that was we ended up going to Wheaton, Illinois one day together, sat in this room with these crazy conservative pastors who made us confess like that we thought about each other when we were masturbating, like crazy stuff.
My God.
And then started pouring holy water over our private parts and speaking in tongues. And
for real.
It was insane. And it's those experiences that it was just like, this is not Christianity as I see it in the gospel. This is just shit.
It's sick.
Wait a minute. Yeah. Wait a minute. So these conservative pastors were in this room and they had you guys' pants down.
No, we didn't get naked.
Oh, okay.
I stood up. We both stood up. I still remember it so vividly. They're laying hands on us, praying, like yelling in tongues. And then they have holy water in there over your head, and they pour it on your crotch region, and just like asking God to cleanse you and whatever.
Wow.
Insane. Just insane.
I'm really sorry that you had to go through that, man.
It's crazy.
Thanks. Yeah, that was the only part of conversion therapy that was hard, is actually having to do it with somebody that I had. Now looking back, I can see that I was in love with somebody, and here we are having to really hurt each other because we think that that's the only right way to do things.
Has he come out? Is he, you know, out and proud, or is he still like really conservative and holding it in?
Yeah, so there's parts of that story I can't go into, but he's out now. He has a partner, but he ended up getting married. I was in his wedding to a woman, and then that fell apart eventually. Gotcha. And so, yeah.
Wow.
I've heard that way too many times.
Yeah.
It happens a lot.
Yeah.
But what do we do? I mean, what's the end goal here? Like, what are we supposed to do with the knowledge, right? So we've got this knowledge of Christ, right? This revelation of loving people and that we can be gods and all this, right? What's the next step for Christianity?
Yeah. I mean, I think...
Or does Christianity allow there to be a next step, even?
For a lot of people, the next step is to leave Christianity. That's true. And I've always said that day one I stepped into the pulpit here, I said, we have a revolving door policy, meaning that we are going to take in, our church brings in the people that are spiritually abused and broken and have been hurt by the church, and they're giving it one last shot to see if there could be space for them in Christianity. And what I've discovered is oftentimes people will come, they will find healing here in what we've cultivated as this community where we are radically honest and open about this stuff. And then once they reach this place of spiritual healing, they leave and they go do something else on Sunday mornings. And I think that's okay. I think the role of Christianity at its healthiest is what we're trying to, again, sounds kind of egotistical to say it this way, but I think what we're trying to do here is to be that place where people can come, find healing, find a different way of being Christian. And if they want to stay a part of the religion forever, we're going to exist here. Please be with us. And if not, we can send people on their way to go do yoga on Sunday morning instead. And like, God bless you. That's great. We're excited for you. But I think for me, that's the different posture that we're taking now, is it's not about converting people to fill the pews forever. It's about being a waypoint for people to find healing. And I mean, Jesus said that there was going to be a day that comes where people would no longer would worship God in spirit and in truth, not in the institution of the temple, but on their own. And I think I'm happy with people who come to the church, find healing, and can walk out and live as whole people, being influenced by the way of Jesus, but they don't have to necessarily be a part of a Christian church, if that makes sense.
It does.
That's a powerful message that the world needs to hear right now, because that's not how the majority of Christianity functions. It's all about us versus them. And that's the opposite of us versus them. That's the message of unity and concern and compassion. That's powerful.
Yeah. Now we just need to survive this election and maybe we can actually do some work on Christianity. But yeah, I mean that honestly though, it's like, I got into this, right? Because I wanted to reform Christianity from the inside out, and not to overdo it, but we're literally facing existential threats as a species right now. And so as a pastor, I'm really like struggling with how do I keep doing this church thing, which I think is so important, but also how do we motivate and organize people to deal with, like, set aside the philosophical questions for a little while and let's figure out how we actually keep our immigrant neighbor from getting taken away by ICE tomorrow. Like, anyways, to put a damper on the parade.
It doesn't, and it's something that needs to be said, and it's beautiful. And I think that's part of Chris's question of where we go from here. You know, you answered it.
Yeah.
I think it's a two-part question. It's like, this is what I'm doing, but yeah, this is what Christianity is up against. And For someone myself who still wants to identify as Christian, I'm still, that's what I love. I mean, that's why I'm like tearing up, like listen to him, like, I wish if I was in San Diego, brother, I'd be filling your pew on Sunday, some Sundays, maybe not during football season, but we'll see. But anyway,
such a straight answer. Anyway,
I mean, are you straight shaming me right there?
Wait a minute, that's a stereotype. That's a stereotype.
Straight people deserve to shame him all you need every now and then.
That's true.
That's fine. But no, and I like that, because that's my struggle with Christianity currently, is in the political realm and climate. And I love how you say Jesus's message really is political if you apply it politically, and it should be, and it should be, and there's a lot of answers there, I feel like, personally. But when you do that, it's just so weird in a two-party system and the party lines, and neither parties really care about the people. And so people can claim, well Trump is pro-life, and Jesus was clearly pro-life, and so then you can't be anything other. But then it's like, but then what about, like you said, the immigrant? What about your neighbor? What about everything else Jesus was actually saying? And what is your, like, and so, like, it's just, I don't know what the answer is with that. You know, I normally just, especially we're talking about Facebook, you're talking about TikTok, I'm not on TikTok, I don't know the world of that and how that works. Seth shared a couple of years and they were great. Normally things that Seth shares from TikTok isn't, so
they make fun of me every day, Brandon. I'm not allowed. We have a Marco Polo group for our community.
Oh, we need to get you in the Marco Polo group, Brandon.
They have restricted me from sharing TikTok, so I'm really sorry. I would like to share your stuff all over the place, but they don't allow me anymore.
Were you sharing the shirtless men videos dancing? That's what I watch when I'm not watching Theology.
Yes. I mean, that's at times, but they really frown upon that. And so I try to do like a little bit of that with some humor.
Me and Seth got an argument one time about cops doing TikToks while they're on the job. That's a whole nother story, and I'm derailing myself here. Although it's more fun than political conversation. What is the answer? What do you do? Because I have a lot of my family and people that used to be friends, some that still are. I mean, I'm not going to like defriend people who are Trump supporters. It's not, but it's so in your face. It's so divisive. And it's like, and if you try to comment on it, it's, you can't, there's no winning, you know, and then you go back to the whole big dick mentality thing, and where
there it is again.
So
third, I think it's an accurate metaphor for this.
I'm sorry that I'm distracted you, Seth, but I mean, I know you're nervous already to be in this conversation.
Seth has been over there on Scruff the whole time. That's why he hasn't been talking.
No, in this conversation, he has not.
That says a lot. Touched a gay app since this interview
started. That says
started.
A lot, Brandon. May let me just say, clarify. That says a whole lot about you as a person, because I think that's one of the first interviews that he's not been on his phone, and he's been attentive the entire time. So,
shut up.
You understand what I'm getting to. I don't even know how to phrase my question, because I don't know what the answer is, but no. Go ahead.
Basically, is how do you get rid of your Trump-supporting family members?
No.
How do we deal with them? How do we deal with them?
I don't know if this is the right answer. I really don't know if it's the right answer, but it's what I'm doing. For the past 8 years now, I've been involved in faith-based political groups that are progressive. And there is a growing religious left. And again, like, there's part of me that's like, why just do the opposite of what conservatives are doing? But then there's another part of me that says, the way you change a culture is by winning. And I think... there's a lot of us progressive clergy that are really getting involved in political activism, saying like, we've got to help get these politicians and policies in place that represent the values of the common good. And so, I mean, that's what I spend my time doing. I'm a campaign advisor for the Biden campaign. I was working for Pete Buttigieg when he was running, trying to help organize faith people to support these candidates, because whether or not I agree with everything they support, whether or not I like candidates as people, it's like, yeah, I would rather absolutely have a candidate that would be more progressive than a Trumpian Christian candidate. And if we know that the conservative Christians are spending millions of dollars to help get Trump reelected, liberal Christians might as well use our resources and time and energy to try to help get people we think align with the way of Jesus elected.
Yeah, Jojo Horgeson. Let's do it. Put the money back.
Yeah. Yeah.
No. It's hard. So, but seriously, you've been, you're in deep, you know, you've chosen your party line, but what are you laughing at, Chris? Let me ask my question.
The metaphor, you're in deep.
Yes, that is funny.
That's where my mind goes. I'm sorry.
We already know that he's got the biggest dick in the room. It's been swinging. So he's in.
Well, you don't have Jesus to help guide you and keep you from your sinful lust and nature.
Guide you in deep. So anyway, here we go. What do you do? You may not have very many Trump supporters on your timeline at this point, eight years into your. Yeah. So. How do we, I don't want to like fight politically with these people. You know, I don't think that Jesus would either. I mean, no. I don't know, but like, I don't see Jesus going to the polling booth, really voting for either of the candidates. You know what I mean? I don't know, but maybe I'm wrong.
You would vote for Joe Biden. Get that straight right now. But,
thank you. Thank you.
He would say, give to Caesar what is Caesar's. That's what I think he would say.
Yeah. I think, so if we're talking about who would Jesus vote for, I think Jesus would participate in the political process and did as much as he was allowed to. And I do think there is something worthwhile for Christians, if you're going to claim to be a Christian, to hold up the red letters of Jesus and hold up the policies of both candidates and say which one aligns. I think there's something there. But if we're talking about how
the
to
baby
actually
killing.
Interact constructive. Yeah. So on that one, I mean, it's so sad to see the whole way that conservative Christians became pro-life was literally a political move by the Christian Coalition 40 years ago, sitting in a room saying, how can we gain influence? And I've been on TikTok trying to help people see that, because people just think, oh, this is what Christians have always believed. No, you are literally being used, literally. This whole pro-life one voter issue is the most effective political campaign, I think, in American history. And the truth is, no candidate is pro-abortion. Every candidate wants to see abortions reduced. And the question is how we do it.
And usually abortions are reduced under liberal leadership.
Yeah. Totally. And pro-life is bullshit, because those same administrations, you see like the death toll, you see prisons and there's not.
And let's get real.
Yeah.
How many abortions do you think Trump has been responsible for?
Exactly. Exactly. And that has been one of my mentors, Father Richard Rohr, said that the evangelical support of Donald Trump will be an indictment against the validity of evangelicalism for generations to come. I think that is so true, precisely on these issues. There's zero consistency in evangelicals who claimed to be the moral majority to get behind Donald Trump. It clearly shows for the world to see that it's about power and privilege. It's not about values. And they just keep digging their own grave here. Like, they just keep doing it. And I do think it's going to, in the long term, hurt evangelical credibility, certainly with millennials and Generation Z, but also with other generations.
Oh, yeah, they're done. Absolutely. Yeah. It's over. I really think so too.
Yeah. Or if nothing else, they'll probably die out, because it seems like the younger generation, like, I mean, there are some, you know, hardcore conservatives that are being raised, and I just don't get it. Like, I just don't see how you can, but anyway. Yep. Man, it's been a pleasure, Brandon.
Well,
go ahead.
It's good to hang out with you.
Wrap us, Seth.
I was just going to say, this was an awesome conversation. I think we went a lot of different ways, but I think we covered a lot of ground. I think we covered a lot of ground, and I think that this is a really beneficial conversation for people to hear. But to wrap this up, Brandon, kind of tell us, how can people find you? Tell us about some of the things you've done, how we can maybe promote you and get your name out there. Of course, I think it's already out there, but you know what I'm saying. How can we support you? Tell us about your stuff.
The best way to get connected is the website, brandonrobertson.com. All social media, all the books, all of that's there. But also, as we talked about, I've been on TikTok for the past month and a half, and I spend ungodly amounts of time every single day doing it. And even if you're not a Gen Z or millennial, you should get on TikTok, because it's remarkable. it's remarkable the impact that that platform has in the world. And so anyways, TikTok or BrandonRobertson.com.
So. Awesome.
All right. And what is your most recent book?
I just came out with a devotional, which don't throw me off the podcast for saying that, but because devotionals were never my favorite thing, but I wrote a progressive Christian devotional for men, and the idea was to get it in the hands of evangelicals who read toxic masculinity materials and kind of deconstruct that. So it's called Strength and Faith, and it came out 2 weeks ago.
Awesome.
So.
I love it. All right, yeah. And if, you know, more people were gay like yourself, we'd have less abortions. So it works out.
That's why I'm promoting the gay agenda all day.
Chris, that's how you're going to end this interview?
Hey, look, Brandon, I really like you. You know, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us. And I'd just like to say, you know, it'd be cool to have you back just to talk politics at some point, you know, certainly with the election coming up. We have your story, but, you know, maybe next time let's talk politics. And honestly, you need to hit us up on our Marco Polo app. Seth, make sure to give him the information for that. We'd love to have you over there. Our community would love to talk with you. And I just appreciate you so much for your time. And it's been a great conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I'll see y'all here tomorrow. Same time, same day.
Sounds good, man. Appreciate you.
All right. We're off live.
Okay.
Awesome.
Yeah,
man.
Thanks a lot, man. Wow.
You did great.
Really cool.
You did like really good answers.
Good.
I don't know if you do this like all the time, but like you definitely thought about like all the stuff that we, you know, we're bringing up. So really good answers.
Yeah. I appreciate the conversation, y'all. I didn't know what this was, but I'm super excited. This was such a fun experience.
Good. Thank you for saying that. Yeah.
It's an experience.
Honestly, that's the whole like. That's what we want to do for our guests is like really just make you feel at home. So you may like tell stories that you may not normally tell, but not to like get you like in a compromised situation, but just so like just it's more fun that way, you know, like cause it's not rehearsed and it's more freeform and it's like it's awesome. Yeah. So thank you for saying that. That's kind of like and you were perfect. I mean, like we said it live and we weren't just like blowing smoke up your ass, man. We'd love to have you around.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.